Welcome to this Forthright Radio for April 3rd, 2019. I'm Joy LaClaire. Later this month, April 26th, marks the 33rd anniversary of one of the greatest disasters in human history, the explosion of Reactor 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine, at that time in the Soviet Union. Our guest today, Adam Higginbotham, spent more than 10 years researching that event, conducting hundreds of hours of interviews with those involved in the disaster itself, as well as its aftermath. He has written a monumental account titled Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster, published by Simon & Schuster. Adam Higginbotham's narrative nonfiction and feature writing has appeared in magazines including The Smithsonian, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Independent, The Sunday Telegraph Magazine, Wired, and elsewhere. He is also the author of 1,000 Pounds of Dynamite, about the fiendish plot against a Lake Tahoe casino to extort with the largest improvised explosive device in American history. Well, with that by way of introduction, we welcome you to Forthright Radio, Adam Higginbotham.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I can't thank you enough for what you must have gone through to produce this book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. It truly is a monumental work. It's 538 pages long, includes over 200 pages of footnotes, glossary, maps, diagrams of the nuclear power plant and reactor housing, photos, bibliography, and yet it is written almost as a thriller or whodunit with plenty of human interest, and I mean that in the best sense of those words. As I mentioned, it took over 10 years to research and write. Whatever prompted you to begin?
Well, I should say I wasn't only working on this for 10 years, otherwise I think I'd have gone kind of crazy. But I began reporting on the subject back in 2006 when I went to Moscow and to Kiev for the first time to report a magazine story. And at that time, I was exclusively focused on trying to find surviving eyewitnesses to what had happened and to try and reconstruct the events of the disaster through their eyes. And then when I began talking to them that I realized that a lot of what I'd read playing wrong.
You start the book in a gentle way, shall we say. Nuclear-powered electricity generation was the other side of the nuclear weapons industry, and our listeners may have heard about President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace proposal and assumed that the United States was the first to connect nuclear power to the electric grid, but actually, we were not even the second to do so. Would you tell us briefly about that part of the story?
Certainly at the outset, you know, the Soviet Union were world leaders in civilian nuclear technology because they did manage to build this reactor in Obninsk, a few hours' drive outside Moscow, which was the first nuclear reactor that was connected to the grid to generate commercial electricity. There are a lot of different qualifiers in this classification of who was first, because I think that actually the United States was the first country to produce a reactor that generated electricity, but because it wasn't connected to the grid, the Soviets, therefore, you know, could claim to have got there first. And in the 50s, you know, they were world leaders in nuclear technology, and it wasn't until later when the time came to expand this around the country and to produce a proper commercial proposition with a network of nuclear reactors to generate electricity that they began to fall behind. And it was in their effort to catch up with the United States that they began to really rush things, and this was kind of the beginning of the problems that ultimately led to the Chernobyl accident.
Adam, you did a marvelous job of explaining the three main requirements in a reactor to produce power. Would you briefly describe them for our audience?
I think I can. You need uranium fuel, and then you need a moderator, which facilitates fission, and you need a coolant in order to make sure that the uranium fuel becomes hot enough to generate steam from the water flowing around the reactor, but not so hot that it melts or catches fire.
Yes, and therein lies the difficulty, shall we say.
Yes.
Adam Higginbotham, you establish early in the book what a hopeful, humane, and civilized, forward-looking approach the Soviet government took in creating the nuclear power plant at Chernobyl, and especially the Atomgrad for the workers. Would you tell us about that?
This is one part of the story that I was extremely anxious to kind of bring to wider attention, because it was something that I felt in the accounts that I'd originally read of what happened, the prelude to the accident had really been missed out of the story, and it made what most people understood to be the series of events to be kind of lopsided to my mind, because I wanted to show how this Atomgrad in for the Chernobyl plant, which was a nuclear city that was built just 3 kilometers from where the reactors were, specifically to house the people who worked at the plant and their families. The city was named Pripyat, and it was deliberately constructed in such a way that it was an incredibly appealing place to live. So it was surrounded by open countryside. The place was designed to have, you know, all of the most modern conveniences available within the Soviet Union. So there was a yacht club, there was a scuba diving club, there were stores that stocked things that you couldn't get even in larger cities in the Soviet Union, like Kiev and Minsk. So you could buy fresh vegetables that are unavailable elsewhere. You could get Austrian furniture and French perfume. And you could buy these things without, you know, putting your name on a waiting list, which was the case elsewhere in the Soviet Union. So it was designed this way so that it would attract the kind of cream of nuclear engineers and energy experts from around the Soviet Union. And that's what it did. And it became a place where young families came to start their lives in this, you know, optimistic vision of a nuclear-powered future. And so that by the time of the accident, the average age of the citizens, I think, was 26. And more than a third of those people were children. And it was filled with playgrounds and swimming pools, and it was built on the banks of a river with white sand beaches where you could go and sunbathe and swim in the summer, and people took boat trips up the river. Although this is relative, because if somebody from Ohio had visited in, you know, 1975, they maybe wouldn't have thought much of it. You know, all the buildings looked the same, and it was Soviet architecture. But the people from elsewhere in the Soviet Union, this was a kind of real workers' paradise.
Yeah, and they did that on purpose, and it almost, in my mind, kind of adds to the tragedy of the story, which is tragic enough
exactly,
as it is.
Exactly. I wanted to show this part of the story is because, you know, I wanted to allow the reader to understand not only what it was like to live through the accident itself, but what it was like to live in the Soviet Union in the mid-1980s, and to understand what it was like to live in Pripyat, so that people could understand that, you know, not only was this a terrible accident, but the people who lived in Pripyat had also lost this kind of wonderful life that many of them lived beforehand.
Yes, and I mentioned that there's a human interest element throughout the book, and it sort of begins with Viktor Bruchanov. Is that how you say his name?
That's it. Yeah, that is right.
He was sort of like the one man running the whole thing from the before Pripyat was created through when it was evacuated. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, so Viktor Bruchanov was the director of the station, and he arrived at the site of what was to become the Chernobyl power plant in 1970, when it was just an empty field that had recently been purchased from a nearby collective farm. And he told me how when he arrived for this kind of founding ceremony with ministers from Kiev and Moscow, that he and the ministers just stood up to their knees in snow in this completely deserted place, and they watched a ceremonial stake being driven into the ground. And at this point, he was only 35 years old, so he was incredibly young to be given responsibility for, you know, this enormous enterprise that he was then going to have to build from the ground up, literally from the stake in the ground. He was going to have to build a nuclear power plant. Before he did so, he was responsible for building all the infrastructure that was necessary to build it there in the first place. So he had to build a rail spur, he had to organize the arrival of all the materials, and all the construction workers who were actually going to put this thing up in the first place. And it was incredibly difficult. And not only because of, you know, the bottlenecks and restrictions of the Soviet Union's centrally planned economy, but also because he had loads of labor problems and there were constant political conflicts. And so he told me that before the first cubic meter of concrete had even been poured into the ground, he went to Kiev and he tried to quit. And they just told him, you know, his superiors from the Ministry of Energy just told him that he had no business trying to resign from his responsibilities to the motherland and just sent him straight back to work. And the whole thing took years, but by the time of the accident, Bryukhanov had, you know, dedicated the majority of his life to the energy industry and to realizing this atomic city and the four reactors of the Chernobyl power plant. And he had turned, I think in 1985, so just the year before the accident, he turned 50. He celebrated his silver wedding anniversary. And everything was looking up, and he was expecting to be promoted to a job in Moscow. He'd spent all these years as the director of the power plant, and he was going to be rewarded by being given a job in Moscow, which is where everybody who worked in the Soviet Union ultimately wanted to go, because it was the center of everything. And so, obviously, the last thing on his mind was this long-postponed safety test that had been finally scheduled for the night of April the 25th into the 26th of 1986.
Okay, we'll get back to that in just a moment, but I want to observe another anniversary. Just last week was the 40th anniversary of the partial meltdown and release of radioactive gases into the atmosphere at Three Mile Island. That was March 28th, 1979. And one might think that it would have been played up big time in the Soviet Union, but in fact, it was censored. Now, why didn't the Soviets seize that propaganda opportunity?
Because I think that they felt that the propaganda opportunities were outweighed by the problems it would cause by drawing attention to the potential perils of nuclear energy. So they deliberately kind of played it down in the way it was reported within the Soviet Union. They didn't want to kind of sully the broader appeal of nuclear energy, which within the Soviet Union was regarded as this panacea of progress and the ability of the state to bring electrification to every corner of the Soviet Union. And within the Soviet nuclear industry itself, I think that they were quite complacent about the accident in Three Mile Island. The official line was that this had only happened because, you know, the American nuclear engineers were incompetent, and the people who staffed the plant at Three Mile Island had all just come out of the Navy, where they worked in nuclear submarines. And they were totally unlike the extremely skilled and highly trained Soviet nuclear engineers, who were much better at their jobs than the Americans. So there are all sorts of reasons that it was played down, but it certainly was.
Well, it's interesting that you framed it that way, because I recall vividly in the weeks after Chernobyl happened, when the people around the world were very panicked by it, a science teacher at a local school was reported to have said that it was due to the lax training and incompetence of the Russian nuclear technicians. So each side kind of felt the same way about the other side whenever any of these problems happen. Well, anyway, when reactor 4 at Chernobyl was built, it was an RBMK-1000 design, which was pretty much the standard design all over the USSR. There had already been problems with other facilities, and design flaws were recognized. Describe some of them and what steps were taken to overcome them, and how did the design differ from those used in the United States?
The answer to both those questions is actually very similar. The RBMK design was, as you say, completely unlike the ones that were used in the United States, because it was graphite moderated and water cooled, and it had been developed from the same principles that were used in military reactors that had been built to create plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. And the fundamental problem with these reactors, unlike the ones that are used in the United States, which are water-moderated and water-cooled, pressurized water reactors, the problem with a graphite water reactor is something called the positive void coefficient, which is a syndrome that means that these reactors are very susceptible to running away, which simply means that the operators can lose control of the fission reaction going on inside the reactor core. And this can lead very quickly, if it starts taking place, to a meltdown or an explosion. So that's the one fundamental problem with the RBMK, is that it, like all other graphite water reactors, is very susceptible to this. And there were a whole host of other design faults that they began to discover as soon as they put them into production. They're in such a rush that they didn't even bother with a prototype stage. And although there were whistleblowers inside the Soviet atomic energy industry who pointed out that they felt this reactor was too dangerous to put into civilian operation, they're ignored, and production went ahead anyway. So it was only after they built the first one, which was built in Leningrad at the beginning of the 70s, did they begin to notice that there were all these other faults. And there's a whole chain of them, but the most important and most dangerous one was not discovered for another 10 years or so, and this was that a fault in the design of the control rods. Now, the control rods are designed simply to regulate the amount of reactivity within the reactor core. So essentially, if you want to make it produce more power, you withdraw the control rods, and if you want to quench the reactivity within the core and produce less power, you can insert the control rods. And ultimately, if you want to shut it down, you just simply press a button and you can insert all the control rods at the same time. Now, the problem was, in order to save money, to make the reactor produce as much energy as possible and to be as efficient as possible, they designed the tips of these control rods in such a way that under certain circumstances, for a fraction of a second after you inserted the emergency control rods to shut the thing down, instead of reducing reactivity, it could briefly increase reactivity. Now, although the designers knew that this happened, they regarded the circumstances under which it could happen as extremely rare and not something that really needed to be addressed. And it was this, which is a kind of crazy inversion of a safety system. It's as if the brakes and the accelerator pedal in a car work the wrong way around, so that you're driving along at 60 miles an hour, you stamp on the brakes, and suddenly the car jumps forward and starts going at 70 miles an hour. And it was this problem that was the final precipitating cause of the accident in 1986.
Okay, well, that's a little more than 7 years after the Three Mile Island incident. We get to the night of April 25th, 1986, and the early hours of April 26th in Reactor 4 at Chernobyl. Set the scene for us, Adam Higginbotham, and what happened?
So, on the night of the 25th, the operators of Reactor 4 were tending to perform a long-postponed safety test. They had been supposed to conduct when the reactor first came online at the end of 1983, but in order to meet a production target, they just quietly postponed it. And they waited until there was a scheduled maintenance shutdown. So the reactor had been online for 3 years, and it was going to be shut down so they could just perform sort of routine maintenance on the reactor and turn the thing off for a while. And they were going to use this opportunity to conduct this safety test. And everything was initially set up to take place on the afternoon of the 25th, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And a team of experts had come in, electrical experts had come in from Donetsk in the east of Ukraine to supervise what was regarded as principally an electrical test. You know, nuclear engineers didn't really take much interest in it because they didn't really think that it had much to do with the reactor itself. It was a safety test on a subsidiary electrical system. And everybody was expecting it to take place at 2, but when the operators called the dispatch office of the grid in Kiev to ask for permission to take the reactor offline, they were refused permission to do so because all the factories in this part of Ukraine were rushing to meet their final end-of-month deadlines before the May holidays. So they needed every watt of electricity they could get their hands on at this point. So the dispatcher said, well, no, you can't take the reactor offline now. You're going to have to wait, and it's not going to be until 9 o'clock tonight at the earliest you're going to be able to do that. So this team who were all ready to do the test would just have to sit around and do nothing while they waited for the hour to begin to come around for them to do the test. But then they got the thing ready to do the test, but it wasn't until midnight that they were finally ready to perform it, at which point that shift of people went off. And then the midnight shift came on and arrived at the reactor. And they, correspondingly, were expecting not to have to perform the test because they thought the test had been performed in the afternoon, and that they were just going to be overseeing the cooling of the reactor, which is relatively easy work. And the reactor operator who arrived for that shift to take control of reactor number four was Leonid Toptunov, who was in his mid-20s, and although extremely well-trained, had only been in this position for 2 months. And when he took control of the reactor at midnight, he began to make the preparations for the test, but skipped a stage in what he was supposed to do, and suddenly watched as the reactor power plunged almost to zero. Now, at that point, for various technical reasons, they should probably have just shut the reactor down and abandoned the test. But that's not what they did. At the insistence of Anatoly Dyatlov, who was the administrator in charge of making sure the test happened, they brought the reactor up to the power level that was necessary to begin the test. But in so doing, brought the reactor into an extremely unstable state. And then they began the test with the reactor in this extremely unstable state, which made it vulnerable to a whole host of these faults that the Atomic Energy Authority in Moscow had known about but had done nothing to correct since they discovered them. Now, the test itself, which began around 1 o'clock in the morning, took only 36 seconds to complete. And during the course of those 36 seconds, Toptunov and the other nuclear engineers in the control room of Reactor 4 didn't see any problems. There was nothing indicating that there were any faults or power surges or anything on their instruments. And at the point when the test was complete, the order was given to shut down the reactor. And they just pressed the button, which would bring all of the control rods all the way down into the reactor to shut it down, as I described before. But what happened after he had pressed this button was he suddenly saw in his instruments evidence of an unexpected power surge. By this time, there was nothing they could do because the rods were already descending into the reactor. But it was this power surge that then resulted in a runaway reaction and a massive explosion. And the massive explosion blew the top off the reactor, destroyed the roof and two walls of the reactor building, and began billowing this huge column of radionuclides into the atmosphere. And that was the beginning of the accident.
We're speaking with Adam Higginbotham about his book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster. Well, that was an admirable summation of what you put in your book.
I dread being asked that question because it's so complicated that it's extremely hard to condense into an understandable answer, I think.
Yes, it is, and you did a great job. I just want to emphasize what you had said earlier, though, about the design of the rods that were supposed to moderate the chain reaction. I understand from what you wrote that it was that choice to put the tips the way they did that caused, instead of cooling it and moderating it down, to actually cause that flare up. Did I get that right?
Yeah, the rods are designed to regulate the reaction. In the way that they were used at the end of the experiment, they were intending it to completely shut down the reactor and reduce reactivity to zero very quickly. But what happened is that because they had brought the reactor into this extremely unstable state, there were these hot spots already blooming deep inside the reactor that they had no idea were there. And it was when the tips of the control rods met these hot spots that the runaway reaction began and the explosion ensued.
So there's this explosion. Pretty quickly, everything went dark. How quickly did that happen? Because that was a big part of the problem immediately.
When you say everything went dark, you mean that the authorities kind of attempted to restrict information?
No, I mean in the control room, in the plant, the electricity went off. There was no light. The way that the people who were there had to respond was with what few flashlights they had. Do I have that right?
Well, in the control room specifically, you know, the lights winked out as soon as the explosion happened, but emergency generators kicked in then, and emergency lighting did come on. Because the control room, you're right, is a completely windowless room, sort of deep in the bowels of the reactor building. But they did have light to see by inside the control room.
I see. So there's chaos. Nobody knows what's going on.
Buildings had collapsed and walls had collapsed and large parts of the building had been destroyed in the course of the explosion. Those areas of the buildings were definitely dark.
Briefly describe what they had to deal with, just trying to figure out what the heck happened. Because this had never happened. They were not prepared for this. And in fact, even as they did figure out what was happening and assessed it, people elsewhere just wouldn't believe them because it couldn't happen, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I guess there's two things to say here. One is that it would be comforting to think that in the West, reactor engineers and nuclear power station designers were prepared for an event like this. But the truth is that nobody in the world had really prepared for an accident as profound and as catastrophic as this. So yes, they were unprepared for it, but, you know, so were we. And the second thing is that you know, talking to people who were there, talking to Bruhanov himself and to the people who were around him at the time, and reading memoirs that some people wrote in the immediate aftermath of the accident, it's clear that far from being simply ruthless apparatchiks who were denying the obvious evidence in front of their eyes for political reasons or for professional reasons to preserve their positions within the apparat, a lot of people were simply overwhelmed by the enormity of what had happened. And there are nuclear professionals who simply couldn't comprehend that this had happened, because they had spent much of their careers being told by the people above them that such a catastrophic accident was simply impossible. Although, you know, many of them were nuclear physicists, nuclear engineers, who understood the principles of nuclear fission and the principles behind reactor design and what could happen inside a nuclear reactor, they nonetheless were incapable of comprehending that the reactor had exploded. So there's one guy in particular I'm thinking of named Boris Prashinsky, who was the head of this nuclear accident task force, which had never been called out before and had come down from Moscow. And he overflew the reactor in a helicopter the following afternoon. And he describes in his memoir how he gazed out of the window of the helicopter at the open reactor beneath him and simply struggled to believe that what he could see was really in front of him. So, that overwhelmed a lot of people, Bruhanov included, for several hours after the accident had happened. So it wasn't simply that they were denying what had happened for political reasons, but they just couldn't believe what was happening. It was as simple as that.
Yes, that's actually what I meant. They just couldn't believe it. They didn't believe it.
Right.
We'll forego your superb descriptions of what the people on site, the heroic efforts they made to try to figure out in the dark what the heck had happened. And we'll move on to the morning of the next day when they were able to see visually what had happened. Describe what they saw, would you please?
Well, I mean, what they saw as dawn broke was that this unbelievable scene of devastation. You know, the entire roof of the reactor building had simply disappeared, and one of the walls had collapsed into this kind of ziggurat of rubble. And they could see that steam or white smoke or some kind of vapor was drifting into the atmosphere from the open top of the building. And pieces of the reactor core of graphite, fuel assemblies, pieces of zirconium were littering the ground around the reactor building. And it became quickly apparent that the entire thing had been completely destroyed and they were really facing a total catastrophe.
So you write that there were 7 tons of uranium fuel, including iodine-131, neptunium-239, cesium-137, strontium-90, plutonium-239, and it represented the equivalent of 60 tons of TNT in that blast. I can't comprehend that, so I'm not surprised they had trouble with it either.
The estimates of the strength of the blast vary considerably, but the KGB, I believe, estimated that it was a 60 tons of TNT equivalent.
So you mentioned the smoke or steam or whatever that was visible, and you have a whole chapter on the cloud. Talk about that and the impact that that has had globally?
Well, interestingly, it was the cloud of radionuclides that was released from the reactor in the immediate seconds after the explosion that was how the accident itself came to global attention, because the Soviet government did their best to cover up what had happened, as they had done with previous nuclear accidents that had happened within the borders of the Soviet Union. So immediately afterwards, they made simply no announcement at all. And it wasn't until Monday morning when people began to come to work at a nuclear power station in Sweden, which is more than 1,000 miles away from Chernobyl. And they set off radiation alarms at the entrance to the building, which seemed mystifying. At first, they believed that they had a leak inside one of the reactors at this plant in Forsmark in Sweden, which is north of Stockholm. But they began doing tests and just couldn't figure out where the leak was, although all the evidence that they had initially pointed to the fact that there had been a leak in one of their own nuclear reactors. It was exactly what they expected to happen if in that scenario. They eventually realized that what was happening was that it had rained overnight and that the workers arriving for work at the plant were bringing in nuclear contamination from the parking lot on the soles of their shoes as they arrived for work. And there was no leak inside the plant, but instead, when they began to analyze the spectrum of radionuclides that they found in their samples, they realized that the contamination was coming from a very different type of reactor than the one at Forsmark, and meteorological tests showed that the wind was blowing from the direction of Chernobyl. Even so, when the Swedes began to confront dignitaries in Moscow about this problem and ask them whether there had been any accident or any radioactive release inside a Soviet nuclear plant, the Soviet officials initially denied it. And it wasn't until late on Monday night that they formally admitted that there had been an accident. But even then, they only issued, I think, a three-line statement that made no mention of radioactive releases whatsoever.
We should mention that the incident happened in the night of Friday and Saturday morning. So it was Monday that the workers at this plant noticed in Sweden what had happened. But what about in Pripyat, where the 50,000 people lived, more or less? What happened to them immediately after the explosion?
Nothing happened to them immediately after the explosion, because although the word went out within the town that there had been an accident at the plant, the local Communist Party chiefs insisted that everything go on as normal. So in the Soviet Union, schools were open on Saturday morning, so all the kids in Pripyat were sent to school on Saturday morning, and everybody went about their business. It was just as it had been on Friday. It was a beautiful, unseasonably warm day. The sun was out. People went swimming in the river. They went sunbathing. They went shopping. Everybody was stocking up for the May Day holidays. The schools were open. There was a road race, like a run was organized for the next day, so preparations went ahead with that. People went out and proceeded with weddings that had been organized for that day. And, you know, it would be easy to get the idea that this was just because party officials are incredibly ruthless and people in Pripyat were really ignorant of the truth. But the fact is that there had been accidents at the Chernobyl plant before, and nothing terrible had happened in Pripyat. And so people had got accustomed to the idea that there were intermittently accidents at the nuclear power plant, but it was really nothing much to worry about. The previous accident that had happened at the plant in 1982, they sent decontamination trucks out into the streets of Pripyat, and children played in the decontaminant foam that was left in the gutters of the streets after the trucks had passed. And the main street into town was quietly repaved with new asphalt, and everybody went about their business. So when this new accident happened, initially, you know, there was a mix of this sort of complacency that had been generated by the fact that accidents happened but nobody got hurt, and also the disbelief that we talked about before. So even the power plant workers who lived in the town who weren't on the shift that night, when they began to hear word of an accident at the plant, a lot of them just didn't believe that it was as serious as it really was. And there's one guy I spoke to, Veniamin Perenichnikov, who had been out of town on business and was coming back that morning on the train. And he overheard people on the train talking about this catastrophic accident at the Chernobyl power plant. And he was really proud of his job at the Chernobyl plant and had got a lot of experience working in the Soviet atomic complex, nuclear industrial complex. And he became so furious with what he regarded as this insane rumor-mongering about an impossible event that he almost came to blows with the people he overheard talking on the train. And it wasn't until that night, really, that it began to sink in that something terrible had happened, and word began to go around of an evacuation. But still no formal announcement or information was provided to the citizens of the town. And it wasn't until the following morning that the order was finally given to begin an evacuation. And that evacuation didn't begin until that afternoon.
So you do a wonderful job describing the logistics of evacuating so many people. And people didn't know. They were told, just be prepared to be gone for a few days. So, you know, they would only take what they would need for that, which ended up not being true, to understate it.
Yes.
But so everybody evacuates. But on April 30th, the wind shifts. It had been blowing away from Kyiv, but then it shifts south to Kyiv. And you mentioned this holiday, that's the May Day, May 1st parade. Talk about that and the situation in Kyiv. And tell our listeners, how far, how close is Kyiv from the Chernobyl plant?
It's about 170 kilometers from the Chernobyl plant to Kyiv. I mean, today it takes between 2 and 3 hours to drive. So it's really pretty close. I mean, this is part of the problem with the siting of the plant in the first place, is that it was built perilously close to Kyiv, really. And so the authorities in Kyiv, as authorities in towns and cities throughout the Soviet Union did, had organized an enormous open-air parade to celebrate May the 1st, which is one of the biggest holidays in the Soviet Union. But they became aware the night before that radiation levels in the city were beginning to rise as a result of the shift in wind direction, and radionuclides were being carried on the air toward the city, and some officials tried to suggest that they should postpone the parade. But according to the accounts of the mayor of the city and of the wife of the leader of the Communist Party in Ukraine at the time, who was the effective head of state, Vladimir Shabitsky, Gorbachev called from Moscow and insisted that the parade go ahead. And so these tens of thousands of people marched through the middle of Kyiv in the middle of this spike in radiation levels caused by the drifting of the cloud of radionuclides from the plant. And although, you know, some measures were taken to minimize their exposure, I think that the parade was, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think the parade was supposed to go on for 4 hours, but it only went on for two. All of these people were out in the open with their children during this period of spiking in the radiation levels in the middle of Kyiv.
So you wrote that radiation was up to 2.2 millirentgens per hour then, which is hundreds of times normal. The weather was, as you mentioned, unseasonably warm. So people were not even wearing long sleeve shirts. The children were in shorts. It's just horrifying to learn about that. I'm going to sum up in interest of time. Eventually, 363,000 children and nursing and pregnant women were evacuated to the Far East, but they'd already been exposed to dangerous levels by most standards. And there were, by May 10th, 9,500 people had been hospitalized, more than 4,000 of them children. Well, listeners will have to read for themselves more specifics. I want to get to the liquidators and dealing with the aftermath. Where do you want to begin with that, Adam Higginbotham?
Well, the liquidators was the name given to the people who were brought in to try and contain the results of the catastrophe and the immediate aftermath of it. It was this term liquidation is this Russian military term that is a kind of misleading notion that you can somehow abolish the result of a radioactive accident, that you can somehow get rid of it, liquidate it, and dispose of it. And the truth is that really radioactive material can only be moved around. You can't make it less radioactive. it has to undergo the process of radioactive decay, and that can take tens or hundreds of thousands of years. And they didn't, once again, as with the accident itself, you know, no preparations had ever been made to deal with an accident on this scale. So initially, they just tried to do the best they could. So the first thing they had to take care of was the fact that, as a result of the explosion, the graphite stacks of this massive reactor core had caught fire, and the graphite had become was at its most radioactive, because it was at the end of a full cycle of the reactor, so it had been inside the reactor for 3 years. And so radioactive smoke and pieces of radioactive material were just constantly pouring out of the top of the building. So the first thing they had to do was try and put out this fire. And nobody had coped with anything like this before. They didn't really know what to do. So they began using helicopters to dump sand, lead, boron, and clay into the reactor from the air. And this operation began on the explosion took place very early on Saturday morning, and this operation began on Sunday afternoon and then continued for days. And it took 10 days to eventually put the fire out. And it remains to this day unclear whether or not the work that these helicopter pilots did under extraordinary circumstances was actually worthwhile. It seems quite likely that the fire eventually just burned itself out, and everything the helicopter pilots did was almost completely pointless. And then,
let me interrupt you just for a moment. Would you please talk about the conditions? First of all, for the helicopter people, what amount of radiation were they experiencing?
Well, they were flying very quickly over the reactor on these bombing runs to drop initially bags full of sand into the reactor. And there are some accounts that will have you believe that these guys hovered over the top of the reactor in this kind of blast of neutron radiation and all sorts of foul nuclear isotopes and extremely high temperatures blasting at the top of the reactor. But the leader of the operation, who I interviewed a few years ago, explained that that was actually physically impossible, because if you tried to hover a helicopter over a fire that hot, the helicopter would lose all its aerodynamic pull, lift, and simply fall out of the sky into the reactor. So what they were doing was flying in and then dropping their speed back as much as they could and flying over the reactor. And to begin with, because they had no bombing mechanisms to hit the reactor with by remote control from inside the cockpit, a man had to physically push individual bags of sand out of the open door of the helicopter. So, you know, each time he did this, he was blasted with all of this stuff coming out of the reactor. But the overall commander of the operation insisted to me that he imposed a 25 rem exposure limit on each of his crews. But the fact was that a lot of these guys were, insisted on doing as much work as they possibly could to try and bring this whole crisis to an end. So a lot of the crews went back far more frequently than they were supposed to. And we really have no idea how much radiation they were exposed to, partly because measurements were very difficult to take, and partly because some of the information certainly has been deliberately lost subsequently.
And meanwhile, there's all this radioactive material that was spewed all around the plant, and that had to be dealt with. They attempted to send in machines, but what happened to the machines?
Well, initially they tried using radio-controlled bulldozers as one mechanism to try and, you know, bulldoze away these piles of extremely radioactive rubble. But they didn't work very well. And ultimately, people in radioactively shielded vehicles had to go in to try and shunt the stuff aside. And then they began to resort to an old standby technique of the Ministry of Medium Machine Building, which was the name given to the agency that oversaw the atom weapons program, the USSR, and all of the fuel cycle for the civilian industry. And that method was simply to drain everything in concrete. So they began pumping enormous amounts of concrete onto the top of this often still hot radioactive debris. And that was the initial technique. And then ultimately they began to build what became known as the sarcophagus, which was this steel and concrete structure that they put over the top of the ruins of Reactor 4 in order to keep in the radionuclides and protect it from the surrounding environment.
Well, I was referring, yes, all that is definitely so, but I was also referring to the farther spread fallout, I guess, would be what it is. And hundreds of thousands of military reservists were involved in dealing with that. Talk about that.
Yeah, so they began to bring in the initial response for the liquidation. The manpower was provided by the Soviet army, and it was a conscript army. So most of these men were young, in their early 20s. But quite quickly, they realized that if they kept exposing these people to radiation, they would have no army left to fight any invasion from the West. So they began drafting in military reservists, who are men who had already performed their national service, who'd already been drafted, and then gone back to work and resumed their lives. And these men, many of whom were, you know, in early middle age, were then drafted in en masse over a period of 4 years to come in and try and clean up within what became known as the exclusion zone, this 30-kilometer zone around the reactor. And over the course of the years between 1986 and 1990, at which point they wound down the operation, around 500,000 or 600,000 men and women were brought in to try and liquidate the consequences of the disaster.
And some of the radiation areas were so hot that they could only be, each individual could only be in them for seconds or minutes at the most, right?
Yes, I mean the worst area was the roof of the adjacent reactor unit 3, because again, to save money, when they were building reactor units 3 and 4, they put the reactors into the same building. They were built back to back. So when the explosion took place, a lot of radioactive debris from inside the reactor building of reactor 4 was thrown onto the roofs of reactor unit 3. And when they began building the sarcophagus, they decided that the most expedient way of disposing of all of this radioactive debris on the roof was to throw it back into reactor unit 4, into the ruins, before they covered it up with a sarcophagus. So they were on this extremely tight schedule, and they initially tried using robots to go up onto the roof and to shunt this debris back over the edge of the roof and into the ruins of Unit 4. But the robots, even those that were initially designed to be used on the surface of the moon, proved incapable of coping with the tangle of debris and the levels of radiation, because the intense fields of gamma radiation scrambled the electronics and destroyed the microprocessors within the robots' brains. And although other methods were developed whereby they could use these massive glue pads that could be hoisted up to the roofs on the end of cranes and then used to sort of blot the debris off the roof and then lift it away, SREDMASH, the Ministry of Media and Machine Building, decreed that these devices could not be used, and they wanted it done. They wanted the work done immediately. So in the end, they drafted in more than 3,500 men to do the job by hand. And the levels of radiation on these roofs were so high that indeed the individuals were told that they could only be out there for times of seconds or minutes. And they were given lead aprons and lead caps and lead to put inside their boots, goggles and face masks. And then they were given shovels and rakes and stretchers to carry this stuff away, and just had to dash out onto the roof, do what they could for a few seconds, and then dash back in again to safety. And then they were immediately demobilized afterwards and sent home, having received their lifetime's dose of radiation.
Adam Higginbotham, we are just about out of time. I wanted to give you the final 30 seconds to share with our listeners whatever you wish we had been able to get to.
I hope people read the book and, as you said at the beginning, discover that it's a history book, but it's deliberately written like a thriller, and one that I hope will show people really what it was like to live through the disaster from the beginning and to understand what, you know, these tens of thousands of people who lived in Pripyat really lost in the accident. That it was not just this kind of sensational explosion, but it was really something that overturned so many people's lives in a profound and terrible way.
And I was surprised by how many people who were there and exposed to tremendous amounts of radiation were still alive 20 plus years later for you to interview. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that surprised me when I began the research back in 2006, was that not only were there eyewitnesses around, but several of these people that I spoke to had, as you say, been exposed to enormous amounts of radiation and were still walking around. I mean, indeed, there are people who were... There's one guy who was in the control room at the moment of the explosion who still works in the nuclear industry in Ukraine even now and was recently appointed as the acting head of the Ukrainian Nuclear Safety Authority.
But we're going to have to leave it there. Adam Higginbotham, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio.
Well, thank you.
We've been speaking with Adam Higginbotham. His book, Midnight in Chernobyl, The Untold Story of the World's Greatest Nuclear Disaster, is published by Simon & Schuster. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYXNZ, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Rich Culbertson, I'm Joy LeClaire, and you can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media.